The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
It's Wednesday, the 22nd of May, 2019. On the podcast today, I have David Ciclatira, Executive Chairman of Live Company Group, LVCG. And David discusses the licensing and merchandising agreement they've signed with Licensing Management International Limited. Also on the podcast, Kieran Mazaria, CEO of Cadence Minerals, KDNC, talks about the heads of terms agreement to invest in and acquire up to 27% interest in the former Anglo-American iron ore mine in Brazil. Also, Phil Cleggett, head of corporate development at Emerson, EML ticker there, explains the significance of completing a permitting roadmap for the Chemisette Potash project in Morocco. And Darren Sinden, market analyst at Pepperstone Limited, talks about the US-China trade war, Tesco exiting the UK mortgage market, and European elections. And as always, I've got two lists for you, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs. By the way, you can see those at voxmarkets.co.uk, where you'll see other bits of content. In fact, there's a little article there about Bidstack signs Grid for an in-game advertising. It's a big deal there with Codemasters, a cracking game. Look at the quality in that game, it's phenomenal. Also, you can see Zach taking stock every day. Zach does a daily video, look at the news about stocks rising, and today's covered Bushveld Minerals, Cadence Minerals, of course I checked to Kieran on the podcast, Sound Energy, and also Bids on there. Plus, there's other stuff. There's lots of stuff there. Just check it out yourself. Voxmarkets.co.uk. Oh, and by the way, as always, please, I do say this, but if you get any value from the Vox Markets app, and it's free, of course, so if you get the RNSs in the morning and share those out, or you look at prices on there, anything at all, if you get any bit of value, even though it's free for you to use, please return the favour by giving us a nice rating and review at your app store.
Tired of using different sites to research companies? Vox Markets aggregates key financial details, pricing data, and company news into one place. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is David Ciclatira, Executive Chairman of Live Company Group, LVCG. It's ticker there. David, thanks for joining me.
Good morning to you, Justin.
Yeah, and you've got some news out here, getting into licensing and merch. Well, I like that. My kids always say that. Merchandising, you've done an agreement with the Licensing Management International Limited, which are a very well-placed company. And before we go, as always, David, there's lots of things going on with your company. I like to do this because if someone's tuning in first time, they know what you're about. So give us a brief summary about your company, what you do.
LVGC, Live Company Group, owns a brand called BrickLive. BrickLive is a brand that it is involved with the building, that running shows that are interactive shows using bricks, basically. We are a global business and a global brand, so we have shows from Japan to Switzerland to Dallas. So we're all on a global basis, growing the number of places we are going to be in. We're estimated to be over 60 different events by the year end. We're a relatively new company, but I think the speed of the education and the entertainment mix has taken a lot of people by surprise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So this is interesting because my children are a bit obsessed with YouTube, and they've got stars on there. And these stars are earning very good money just off the revenue alone from YouTube, because they've got tens of millions of followers and listeners. But they're always pushing their merchandise, their merch. You know, my kids have bought their merch, you know. So I know it's an excellent revenue. So
well, you're right. I mean, how old are your kids?
They are 6 and 9.
Mm. Well, there we are. They're a little young, but I have actually become quite a good friends with the guys behind the BTS. You know what BTS is?
No.
BTS is the number one pop group. So you talk about YouTube. It's a Korean K-pop band.
Yeah, yeah.
They're in Wembley next weekend.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yes. I've seen them, yeah.
And, you know, the amount of merchandising they sell per show is astronomic. So, you know, merchandise, particularly in the place that merchandise is really big, is America. I mean, as you know, my previous life, I was in the sports business, and you could always go to an American golf tournament as opposed to a European golf tournament, and you'd find unbelievable amounts of quality merchandise being sold.
Yeah.
So I think, I mean, if I look at our shows, we are targeting to have reached 1 million people by the year end in terms of numbers visiting our shows around the world. Right now, there are some bits and pieces. The Japanese have made some, with our permission, some merchandising, but it's not something that we have pushed because we're a new company and we've got to do one thing at a time. And frankly, when particularly in America, where we've now just launched, I don't know if you saw, there was an amazing press reaction to the Chicago Zoo at Brookfield, and they themselves have come to us and said, look, do you have merchandising? So we've got to get merchandising for our shows, which we're obviously actively doing now. But at the same time, as your brand has grown, you can then license the brand to third parties. And that's what LMI have been successful about over the years that I've known them. And I've known them a long time. And they are a good company that works with quality brands.
Yeah, absolutely. In the R&S, you mentioned they've worked with George Lucas' Star Wars and also
Game
of Thrones.
They were the initial, way back in the day, and it is now sometimes. Time ago, Andrew McConey, who heads up LMI, his first real, I guess, coup was he was asked by George Lucas to launch the merchandising of the then unknown Star Wars. So, you know, you always have to start somewhere, and he's been on at me for the last X years about Game of Thrones, and of course, Game of Thrones, he has the licensing rights for Europe and has done really well for the brand and for himself.
Yeah, and it's such a, like you say, excellent revenue stream. It's so clever as well with Star Wars. Of course, that film lends itself to merchandising so well, and you think they almost could have created that just for merchandising.
Well, it kind of rescued Lego always years ago when Lego was not the Lego we know now, was obviously a struggling company, not as hugely successful, but it's attributed that their relationship with George Lucas and Star Wars basically made Lego. So you're absolutely right, really.
It's so clever. I mean, and in the US, the Americans are so good at it. I mean, I always thought, of, do you know what one of the cleverest films I ever thought was Toy Story? And because essentially you're selling toys. You know, it's amazing.
Well, that's the most interesting thing. Of course, we are Brick Live and we own our IP. And I suppose the next level of development in our quest, our journey, will be to associate ourselves with other IPs. Yeah. So we have built our own IPs. So whether it's Brickosaurus down in Marwa Zoo or Animal Paradise in China, we've linked to the Brick Live brand our own IPs. But I think that the company's grown to such a level now that we can start to look at our own merchandising and our own licensing program. But I do think that there will be a time in the future where people will see the success we've made of our own brand, and we, I'm sure, will enter into discussions with other IP owners. That's an obvious part for the future.
Yeah, and it's so easy to sort of upscale, isn't it? I mean, if you get the demand, you can sort of just, you know, print, well, it's T-shirts, it's whatever, it's pins, whatever. You can sort of make so much more of them.
Everybody who comes to a Brick Live show, let's look at the basics. They are basically kids, but they come with their parents. Mm-hmm. And you can see when you see the actual Lego that's being sold, significant numbers in terms of the local toy retailer or whatever it is who's selling at our show. So people want to spend money. They're in a good environment. Their kids are enjoying themselves. They're there for 5-6 hours. Mm-hmm. So as I said, in America, I think when I spoke to you earlier, they absolutely couldn't believe they couldn't buy a hat or a pin. And reality is that's something we've been working at this actually since January on our licensing, our own merchandising program. This has been fast track for us because LMI sort us out, really, I think. And after a lot of discussion, we've decided to go with them. And I think that the timing is all based around the fact that the biggest licensing show in the world is in Las Vegas in June. So we wanted to be in that. So that's why the announcements now. We have absolutely no, it's a new revenue stream, really, for us in terms of business, your business, your people listening who are either shareholders or would like to buy shares. The reality is that this is a new revenue stream. It's not in our numbers in 2019. It's something we had, I think, in Q1 Q2 or Q3 in 2020. So this fast tracks any revenue stream for the company, which is also good.
Yeah. And do you know what the cleverest thing of all about it is? It's an advert that people pay for. So you sell a hoodie with Brick Live on, you know, and your son, whatever, wearing that every now and again. It's a reminder that Brick Live is happening, and people say, oh, we should go to that again. You know, they're paying for that advert. It's amazing.
Well, not only that, I mean, I'm not a man who runs around in merchandise, but I did have something from one of our early Brick Live shows, and I was wearing it at the airport buying some magazines the other day, and the guy selling me the magazines, W.H. Smith or whatever, said, wow, that's Brick Live. And it's stupid things like that, and you go, yeah. Well, you know, you're right. It is. It goes back to the fact that the undervalue in our company is the fact we own everything, yeah. Whether it's the 100 million bricks that we have at Bright Bricks. It's the IP of everything we have, we own, and we've registered, which obviously is a significant value to the company and its value.
Mm-hmm, absolutely, yeah. And talking about sort of what's coming next, your figures aren't going to be out soon, aren't
figures,
they?
Figures will be out in early June, first week of June, that's really pretty much set now, so... The genuine delay is that we have 100 million bricks, and fortunately all the signs are we actually have slightly more than we thought we had. But the reality is the audit process has, I think, taxed these auditors. Anyway, they've now got a system and it's working. They're weighing the bricks and all that sort of stuff. So that's what's really caused the delay. We thought everything would be done 2 weeks ago, and it's now finally finished.
Wow, that'll be interesting. Okay, marvellous stuff. So in the meantime, David, if someone's listening to this right now, likes the sound of what you're talking about, but are still not following the story yet, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, I own 40% of the company, so everything I do is for the benefit of all the shareholders. I've often said I see ourselves like a Barcelona football club. We are a group of people all working to the same direction, same value. We own our own IP. We are the owners. We're not a licensee. We can't be cancelled, if you like. So we're totally protected in what we do. And thirdly, we're a global business, and our business that is not dependent on any one market. But you know, we're in a short time being across the world, and I think we, as this announcement today shows, continually building new revenue streams.
Excellent stuff, David. Good to chat to you, and no doubt we'll be catching up in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
I'm sure we'll be talking very soon. Thank you. Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Kieran Mazzari, CEO of Cadence Minerals. That's KDNC. Kieran, thanks for joining me.
Thanks again, speaking to you, Justin.
Yeah, and there's a flurry of activity in the stock yesterday. Released some news there. Heads of terms to acquire interest in a former Anglo-American iron ore mine in Brazil. And people say, I see quite a few people say, look at this. That's excellent value for money there, by the looks of it. Because, of course, it's a mine that's had excellent financials, and we'll get into that in a bit. But before we do dig into the RNS there, for people not familiar, Kieran, can you just summarise again what Cadence is all about?
Yeah, absolutely, Justin. So Cadence is an investment company listed on AIM, and we've been investing in various sectors in the mineral resource sector, primarily with lithium and the metals that we're providing, sort of the new energy metals providing electrification of vehicles and our home. But although, in addition to that, we've had assets in iron ore. So, for example, MacArthur Minerals, we've got a 10% stake in that. They signed an offtake with Glencore, and you know, we've also been looking at other assets. So this is one of our strategies, was to start to get involved at an asset level rather than the public co level, and this is fulfilling that. We signed a deal with a lithium asset in December last year, to explore some lithium assets, and also, you know, this one is the next one along the track, which is an excellent asset with some really great potential for revenue and profitability.
Yeah, well, take us into that. So you're going to acquire up to 27% of this. So how are you going to do that, and what's the potential here for you?
Well, so we actually, yes. Yeah, so it's a two-stage investment. The first stage is $2.5 million. The next is $3.5 million, totaling six. That will get us to 27%. As we've said in the in our announcement, you know, we are you know, in discussions with potential strategic investors to fund all or part of this investment via equity. Mm-hmm. So ultimately, that's what we'll be looking to do. And I know people might be distraught with a possible issue of dilution. Ultimately, what we're putting our foot on here is we're having $2.5 million initially, and that gets us 20% of effectively an asset that was previously valued by Anglo American $600 million, which is, you know, it's on their books, that was on their books, and it generated profits about $171 million per year as well. So it was highly profitable. Of course, we've done our due diligence, understand the capital costs, understand the OPEX costs. That needs to be independently verified, so it's not in the public domain. But, you know, it looks highly attractive. And for $2.5 million to be able to get your access to that, especially something that has got infrastructure already there, it has an open pit, it's already got the open pit, it's got the beneficiation facilities and the rail and port, all of which we need rehabilitation, but that would have a substantially lower capex than actually putting the whole building a mine from scratch. Mm-hmm. And we've also got stockpile, so the stockpile there is will be there, and we'll be able to ship that. And our target's to start shipping that, assuming that we do this transaction, it all completes by Q4 this year. So we've got revenue from that, which will utilize that revenue to effectively partly fund the reconstruction, rehabilitation of the mine. So that means less of a dilution for Cadence in that regard.
Yeah. And so your valuation right now, I mean, as a company, is what, sub 12 million at the moment? And
I haven't checked today, but it was 14 million or thereabout, where we have a NAV in terms of our publicly listed assets worth around 7 to 8 million, which everyone can check. So the reality is, and then we have some JVs. So, you know, certainly on a public basis, we're backed by our public assets and our JVs, and this is just adding to it. So it's ultimately, in my view, potential upside on where we are from now.
So this is me doing simplified maths, and this to me in my head looks like a good deal, because I'm thinking, okay, you got 6 million here. They made $171 million profit per annum. Even if you just round that down to 100 million, right, and say you get a quarter, of that, which is 25 million. That's more than your market cap in 1 year, isn't it? Isn't that the way to work that out?
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, as always, there's time to get there. But yeah, I mean, I think in the simpler way, if you want to took it that way, that's really good.
That's being conservative, isn't it? Being conservative, yeah. Really. So we start getting revenue from Q4, and then you reckon you'll get up and running, by 2021? Is that right?
Yeah, so we'll basically start the revenue from shipping the ore, and, you know, we're estimating 18 months to 2 years to ship that ore. And in that time, you're rehabilitating the port, you're rehabilitating the railway, port being the priority, then the railway, then the mine. So by the time in 2021, obviously we have to define that, but we would be looked to start up the mining from the mine, and hopefully shipping out from new production. But Shipping the stockpile from the port is going to take a couple of years just because of the capacity of the port at the moment. But yeah, so that's revenue that just goes basically being reinvested into the mine. So it's a nice, you know, yes, we're taking it out of a judicial review process in Brazil, which requires a lot of work, and that's what we've been doing. Certainly more upfront costs for us, which we've expended quite a bit already to get this over the line. But now it's, you know, I suppose now the hard work starts, which is getting this mine back into production as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And like I say, you have sort of focused more on lithium and EV types of commodities in the past. So why iron ore now?
Well, I think I said before that we're commodity agnostic. We have to look at supply and demand curves across commodities, and of course the asset, the ability to get into the asset cheaply, and look for sort of multiples of return, very high levels of our return on investment. So, you know, the supply and demand curve is still there for lithium. There have been historic issues in terms of financing some of these larger projects, but that looks to be changing. But the iron ore market also, you know, before you know, before the Bermudino was also on the up. We had seen the lows in 2015-14, where you had effectively around 65% iron ore was selling for the $40-$50 a ton. We're now seeing over the period of those last years until September last year, steadily improving, and then so about $95 a ton around that time, and it's improved now dramatically to $111 a ton for 65% iron ore, which is what our project is ultimately going to produce the majority of. So there's a fundamental a supply and demand curve there. In terms, there is a restricting supply, and as a result, unfortunately, of the Bermudino disaster, there is a much more restricting supply in terms of Vale's production, and there needs to be new projects coming along to feed that. One has just to look at, you know, projects like MacArthur, where we got 10%, where Glencore has gone in, financed it, got the offtake. There are people that want this product because of expansion in China and them opening the purses to stimulate the economy there. Mm-hmm. So it's supply and demand rationale. Let's look at the supply and demand. Let's see if there's a squeeze. Is the pricing right? Are we buying close? Well, obviously close to the bottom would be in 2015, but are we seeing a long-term uptrend? And our analysis of the market within iron ore is there's a longer-term uptrend over the next 2 to 3 years while projects come online, new projects come online, and while Vale sorts out this issue in Brazil in terms of tailings dams designs and what are the issues that they need to solve there. So there's a period of time to get this up and running, get it financed, and move it forward, and then you're off to the races, as it were.
Mm-hmm. Marvellous stuff. Okay, Kieran, three reasons, if someone's listening to this right now, why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Very simple. There's three reasons for us. So the firstly is that Cadence is an investment company exposed to multiple assets, both in the lithium sector and now the iron ore sector, both of which are, in terms of supply and demand curves, are going to see continued shortage of supply. So we're in asset classes that are going to, you should see an increase in pricing point. Mm-hmm. Two, all of those assets right now seem to be coming off really well, where we have MacArthur, which we've had for 2 or 3 years, just signed an offtake with Glencore to put their iron ore asset into prepare a bankable feasibility study for their iron ore asset. We've just had Bacanora, which we're a JV holder and a small shareholder in, which has just signed a deal with Ganfeng to finance their project and offtake. We also have an exposure just now to a former Anglo-American iron ore mine, which was valued at $600 million and was generating profit of $171 million. During its height. So we've got and we've got exposure to all of those. And as you just pointed out, we have effectively a NAV of 8 million already built in. So, you know, there's upside across all of those assets. Plus, we've got a basis of our valuation, which is sound.
Mm-hmm. Marvellous stuff. Kieran, good to chat to you. And like I say, you've got a lot of things going on. So no doubt we'll be chatting again in the not too distant future. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Phil Cleggett, Head of Corporate Development at Emerson. EML is the ticker there. Phil, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Justin, as always, a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I've got to admit, I did misread the title of your RNS today, and I thought you were building a road there. That's not the case. Title is Completion of Permitting Roadmap at Chemisette, and we'll dig into that, the detail of what that means and why it's significant, a milestone here. But before we do, let's give people an intro if they haven't listened to the podcast before with you guys on. Can you just say, Emerson, what's it all about, please, Phil?
Sure. Well, Justin, we're listed on the main market of the London Stock Exchange, as you know. Mm-hmm. We have a potash project down in Morocco. Potash is a fertilizer, huge market, and one that we believe presents the opportunities to have a great project with strong margins and so on. That was shown in our scoping study, our first engineering study in November, which had really fantastic results. It showed an NPV of $1.1 billion using independent pricing and EBITDA margins of 64%. So this really gave us confidence to pursue the project very aggressively. and timelines, we're looking to compress them as much as possible. So we think we've got a fantastic project down there. And the next step is a full feasibility study, and we've recently announced the commencement of that during that feasibility study timeline, which we've said will take 9 to 12 months to complete. We will have a huge amount of news flow coming out, as we did in the scoping study. As discrete parts of the feasibility study are completed, we will be announcing them bit by bit and explaining their significance to the overall project. So we're full steam ahead, feasibility study, and as today's announcement shows, we're really thinking about the permitting and getting our heads around it, and hopefully everything will go as planned in that department as well.
Yeah, it's a massive task, isn't it? Building a mine, like I said, so many different pieces of the puzzle have to come together, and a lot of that, of course, can't happen without permits from all the different bodies, from all the different government departments. And so this RNS today is very important on that respect, isn't it? The completion of the permitting roadmap. Take us through what this means, Phil.
That's right. As you pointed out, permitting for a mine of any scale, let alone a quite a large one like we're building, is always, it's a complicated process, no doubt. We definitely believe in Morocco it'll be far simpler than in other places around the world, which is fantastic. But still, there's a lot that we have to understand. And the best way to ensure that we're going to get to the point we need to get to with respect to permitting, when we need to be there, is all about planning. Like anything in life, preparation is key. And today's announcement is just implying that we've done all the planning that we think we need to. We're calling it a roadmap. What it is we've identified every single permit that will be required along the way and when they'll be required. We've double-checked it against, obviously, the legislation in Morocco. We've also gone and spoken to all of the Moroccan authorities that are responsible for those various permits, and we've got a great dialogue with all of those groups. So this is about the planning, and, of course, part of that is the timelines. And really the key here is that we are now, as we said in the announcement, we are comfortable and confident that when we've done the right amount of engineering and we've got the financing in place, we will be in a position to commence construction very shortly thereafter from a permitting perspective. That's a huge, hugely important thing for constructing any mine. And what it really does for us is allows us to pursue all the engineering and spend the money required to get to that point, and also to really go to potential financiers with confidence and say, look, here are our timelines, and the engineering is in our hands. We are in control of that. And also the permitting, here is what we're going to do and when. And this is why we believe that when we're asking you for the money on this date in the future, that we'll be ready to implement our plans at that date. So it is, you know, this is a planning step, but it's a hugely important one, and one that as a result gives us huge confidence to pursue the development of Chemisset.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can't get the physical mine up and running without legislative side parts that are all signed up and ticked off and all the boxes ticked there. So it's hugely important, and it just shows how much organisation goes into it, doesn't it? It's a phenomenal amount of organisation needed.
Yeah, that's right. And look, this is an RNS today saying we've completed the roadmap, and people might say, well, good. But a huge amount of work has gone into this, huge discussions with lawyers and consultants and other mining companies in the country who've been through the process, as well as all the government bodies. And to be able to say, look, we understand the process and we're comfortable that we'll get it done in time is a huge plus for the company.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Cool. Okay, and what's, like you say, you mentioned there is a massive milestone coming up, of course, but what's between now and the feasibility study?
Well, the parts of the feasibility study is the main answer. We will be drip feeding things out as soon as they're available. We'll be announcing the results. We'll be, as we did for the scoping study, we'll have the cost of the port and how much we can use and how much the road will cost us and how much the power lines will cost us, on top of the size of the mine and all these things. As soon as they're decided, they'll be announced, and investors will be able to see the feasibility study coming together as we do. And then, of course, when it's finalised, that'll all be put together in one big presentation as well. Alongside that, we're still drilling. The drill campaign's been going for quite a while. We still do have time left. Drilling takes a long time, and the results of that and an updated resource will be released in the not-too-distant future. We've got metallurgical testing ongoing, and the results of that, of course, will be made public once complete. And alongside that, the things that feed into the permitting, which is predominantly at this stage the environmental side of it, which we have announced before. Recently, we announced we completed our baseline and hadn't identified anything that would materially impact the project, which is fantastic. The environmental studies will continue to progress, and we'll announce those as well. So there's a huge amount of news coming out leading into the one big part, which is the feasibility study. We announced just last month that we'd commence that with a 9 to 12 month timeline, and we're very comfortable with hitting that timeline as well. So it's a big, big 12 months for the company.
Yeah, and I suppose, you know, just talking about potash, it's sort of involved in a mega trend, isn't it? Because when you look at the population explosion we're having and the food needed, then potash is going to play into that trend, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Food security for a growing population, you know, all these things that you keep hearing. One of the best ways to play such a theme as an investor is, of course, to see how can we better produce food and produce more food per available land space. And one of the great ways is potash. It's one of the three macronutrients which go into a vast majority of fertilizers. The supply of it is relatively difficult to get into. So there's not, like some commodities, it's, when a price spikes, new projects pop up everywhere. It's not the case with potash. It's very difficult to get a mine up and running. We're very lucky that we've got one that's very achievable because it's such a low capex compared to other potash projects. So if you want to play the potash space, this is one of the fantastic options. And yeah, like you said, it's a mega trend. It's something that's going to continue. If you don't believe that human population is going to keep growing for a long time, well, you're in a very small minority, and therefore this is something you can really have confidence in on the, over the long term. Commodities like that, where you can really, you know, tie your opinion and say this will continue to be something that's in increasing demand for an extended period. They're pretty rare, commodities like that. So to have one of those as the overall theme behind this project is a huge positive. Yep.
Yeah, yeah, and that's got to be one of your three reasons, surely. So right now, if someone is listening to this, the progress you're making, not yet following the story though, Phil, give them those three reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
Yeah, you're definitely right. The major one, like any project, you've got to look at the macro theme, and over a long term, is this space something that you want to be involved in? And absolutely, potash, which is supplying the ability for us to create more food over a long term, is absolutely a space that you want to be in over the long term. That's, of course, long term, short term as well. This is a very much an in-demand commodity. Over the last few years, the price has increased significantly of potash. And we demonstrated again in one of our recent announcements was the heads of agreement offtake for 100% of our product. There are groups who are willing to commit to buying everything we can produce a significant way out from production. And that's a fantastic starter point for us. And so therefore, I think the commodity itself and being in a space like that is one of the three reasons, undoubtedly. Mm-hmm. The second one, I would say, within potash, like I said, you know, it's not as simple as just going and saying, oh, well, potash is going to be great, so let's find a potash project to invest in. There are two keys, the way that we see it as a company, to developing a potash project successfully. And we think that the first one is low capex compared to the rest of the potash world. And this Chemiset project absolutely ticks that box. It has got less than half the global peer average of capital intensity. So for every ton of potash that we're proposing to produce, it'll cost us in capex less than half the average around the world. So that makes financing this project far more achievable than it would otherwise be. The second key thing you need to find a successful project is location. Are you in a place that's got fantastic infrastructure and access to ports that will allow you to save on a lot of the big capex items that are not related directly to the mine? The answer for us is yes. We're very close to the port. Morocco has fantastic infrastructure and it's in place. It's got a lot of capacity for us to use. And also, Morocco is very close to a lot of huge consumption markets. There are a lot of big markets, Brazil, East Coast US, Southwest Europe, and Africa itself, focused on Morocco, that are consuming a huge amount of potash that they're currently getting from a very long way away. Of course, that saves us a lot of money in logistics once we're in operation. So we tick those two key boxes, low capex and location, that you need to tick to get a potash mine up. So that's a big plus for us. The third reason that I think ties in with today's announcement is Morocco is a fantastic jurisdiction. Of course, its location is fantastic, as I just mentioned. It's close to these large markets. It's got fantastic infrastructure and so on. But also, the government is really implementing across the spectrum a lot of policies that are purely aimed at attracting foreign investment. They're making it as easy as possible for foreign companies to come in and start a business there, including the mining sector as well. They've rewritten the mining codes to specifically benefit foreign companies, and we're seeing the benefits of that already, and today's announcement is part of that. There's great fiscal regime for companies like us with tax cuts and exemptions from income tax for 5 years and these kind of things. So we really feel that Morocco is a fantastic location, and at every chance we get, we tell people Morocco is a fantastic place. It's open for business. It wants foreign investment, and we really want to be the champion of that around the world. So there's three reasons that I think that Emerson should be on the watch list of any of your listeners.
Marvellous stuff. Phil, good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks a lot.
I'm sure we will. Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Darren Sinden, Market Analyst at Pepperstone Limited. You're right, Darren?
Yeah, I am, Justin. As you said earlier, it's a lovely day, sun shining. We're on our way towards a bank holiday weekend, and there's quite a bit going on in the markets. So what's not to like, sir?
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's get into it, first of all. You mentioned there about Huawei, and you know, it's as complex as the pronunciation. But basically, it's because of Trump, isn't it? Google are saying that now they're not going to stock updates for Huawei and all this stuff. And
What's happened is, as we knew that Huawei were being placed on a US blacklist, and that would mean that I think what most people took it to mean was that they couldn't effectively sell their networking equipment into the US, and that perhaps one or two other countries around the world would look at maybe doing the same thing, or at least reconsider their decisions to purchase 5G networking equipment off of Huawei. But what, of course, happened yesterday was something that I certainly hadn't considered, and I'm not sure many other people had as well, was that the focus turned to the actual cellular telephone business or mobile phone business, and Google said that it was considering, it was going to basically restrict the licensing of the Android system and ecosystem to Huawei, and effectively cutting off their access to the Google, you know, universe of apps.
To put it in context, they're the second biggest smartphone seller in the world. So, and they're saying now this will have a massive effect on Western purchases or potential purchases, because they can't get access to that Google App Store, then it'll be a bit of a problem for them. And what do you think of it? In the trade war, I mean, and this is what it's about, isn't it? Trump, let's be honest, he's really ramped it up here, isn't he, by attacking China's one of the biggest telecom companies, you know?
Yeah, he has. I mean, it's just to be clear, they have an 18% share of global mobile phone sales. So yes, they are, a significant player in the space. But what Trump has done, though, is quite subtle,
which is unusual for Trump.
Well, it is. I mean, maybe it's the law of unintended consequences. But what he's done in the past. We've just seen price rises effectively for Chinese goods through the use of tariffs. But here is a move that's actually created a concrete barrier to a Chinese business. Now, it's not the first time he's done this, obviously. They had similar concerns with ZTE last year, if you recall that. But they were quite a peripheral player in comparison to Huawei. And so this has had not only a sort of a body blow effect for Huawei in the short term, but it's also had a knock-on effect to a lot of US companies as well. And that's really what I'm saying here. The trade war is properly heating up. And a good example of... of how, you know, the trade war is having a material effect on investors is to look at the Philadelphia Stock Exchange SOX index. That's the semiconductor index. In the States that tracks exactly that, the major chip makers, both US listed and listed around the world. And just to put that into perspective, the index was down by a whopping 4% yesterday.
And it's seen as a barometer, isn't it? Because there's chips in everything these days, isn't there? So it's seen as a barometer of global growth, isn't it, really?
Yeah, absolutely. And one that's only going to become more and more, you know, applicable as, you know, the Internet of Things gets going and more things become connected. So it's down 4% yesterday, but just in down 15% since the 24th of April. So that's a significant fall. And it's a very interesting exercise if you've got the time to plot a chart of the SOX index and the S&P 500, and you see some tremendous divergence between the two. And given this idea that you say that that the index is seen as a barometer for global growth, that's not a good omen. And another quick sort of stat about the SOX index, I just did some digging this morning, and out of the top 30 stocks within the index, there's not a single one that's actually up now over the month. So if we're looking for sort of omens or indicators about global growth and the future trends over the next 6 to 9 months, then maybe that's one to consider. You know, maybe there is a message in that divergence between the SOX index and the S&P 500 that all isn't well. And that you know, the trade war could hot up further. Morgan Stanley, by the way, had a note out today saying that if you know, there isn't a resolution between the US and China, then they see the real possibility of a global recession. Now, to be clear, that they define a global recession as consecutive quarters where global growth averages below 2.5%. So it's not, you know, contraction across the board. But nonetheless, they say that we could be heading for that scenario. Maybe these chip stocks are the first one of the first things anyway to indicate that possibility too. So food for thought. It's not a done deal. Obviously, the Chinese and the US could still patch things up, particularly at the G20 at the end of June. But at the moment, it looks like it's going the other way rather than cooling.
And also, how fast can economies, you know, big economies, turn around if they're starting to suffer and systematically they are, you know, slowing down? You can't just say one meeting surely will not just turn around the fortunes of, because we're talking about, you know, in China, if you're laying off lots of people, they'll just come back to work the next day, do they, you know?
No, they don't know. We'll get some kind of early heads up about how things are going in China on the 3rd of June, by the way, when we've got the Caixin manufacturing PMI read for the month of May. So a bit, you know, a chance to see how the trade wars have been biting at Chinese economic activity. The balance of payments, balance of trade data for April gave a bit of a clue with falling level of exports, and in particular exports to the US. So let's see what that data brings.
When is that?
The 3rd of June. The 3rd of June. Data.
Cool. Okay, you mentioned the in a pre-note you sent me that Tesco Bank are exiting the mortgage market. This says something, doesn't it?
It does, I think so. I mean, look, they're not the biggest player. They've got a book, current book of around 23,000 loans, which I understand is worth about £3.7 billion. So they're pretty small in the grand scheme of things. But nonetheless, the reason that they're giving up the mortgage business in the UK is because they say that the market is full of challenging conditions. Now, if a company like Tesco, whose whole raison d'etre, you know, whole business life has been about being efficient, running a business on huge turnover and low margins, if they see or decide that there's not really no real opportunity for them to expand their mortgage business and that the competition is too tough, I think that says a lot about the market as a whole.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if it's a case of is it just, you know, too challenging for them as a non-core activity? You know, if it was core, then they'd probably work harder with it. But is it one of the things that Drastic Dave has come in and, you know, got some reports back and say, well, if it's that hard work, just get rid of it. It's not our core. You know,
I think there's probably quite a bit of truth to that, that they prefer to devote their time and money to something they think they can make more money out of. But I do wonder what it says about the market as a whole. What's interesting as well is that we've had recently had numbers from the Nationwide Building Society, and they reported quite a significant drop in profitability. They posted £977 million of profits last year, and only £788 million this year. Costs are rising, and they themselves mention how competitive the mortgage market is. And the last little piece that caught my eye today on the UK mortgage market was an article from Which that was highlighting a new mortgage from the Loughborough Building Society, which for the right person will offer you a mortgage of 5.5 times your salary. So, so we've got pressure being applied, perhaps in terms of competition on pricing on one side, and we all know the problems that Metro Bank have had and their need to raise money to be able to compete in the market. And you've got other players, or admittedly smaller players like the Loughborough, but offering a highly leveraged mortgage to certain buyers. And so, you know, there are echoes there, aren't there, perhaps, of 2006-07, mm-hmm. and you know, the problems we've got ourselves into in that situation. So I'm not saying it's coming to that, but I do wonder. You know, if there's not an omen there from Tesco's decision and that reduced profitability at the Nationwide too, and you know, long term, it makes me think. You know, Metro Bank's problems might not be, you know, completely over. Yes, they've shored up the balance sheet now with the extra cash they successfully raised.
Yeah.
But you know, how what's the future?
I don't believe them. I don't believe them now. I jumped in for a trade right initially. Then the longer it went on without them saying they'd raise the money, I thought, well, I just had to get out because it started falling down. And then I realised, hang on a sec. It's all good and well them coming in saying, oh, we're going to be the bank that has a presence on the high street, unlike the other banks, or, you know. But the other banks are getting out of that because it's financially not viable. So, you know, I think you've got an ageing population, really, that will be less and less care about going into a bank or seeing the real bank. Most people just want to do it online. I can't be bothered to walk downtown to go into a bank. If I can do it online, I will. You know, it's as simple as that. So I think it's a model that will not prove out. And the fact is, when you've got a bank there that messed up on the, you know, fundamentals of banking, which is assessing risk, you know, of certain assets, that doesn't bode well, does it? You know, basics. That's the basics, isn't it, really?
It is, really. And so, you know, watch this space and treat with a bit of caution, I think, would be my thought there towards Metro Bank. And also, I've got my doubts about Challenger Banks generally, if they're not actually, you know, sterling clearers. And the only one that is, as far as I can tell from looking at data from the Bank of England, is Virgin Money. So perhaps if you are thinking of... having a punt in an alternate name, that might be the one to consider. Anyway.
Yes, absolutely. And, of course, in the backdrop of all this, we've got Brexit going on, and I've seen everyone blames... do you know what? I can't forget what it was now, but I know Thomas Cook has blamed Brexit a little bit, but a company recently blamed Brexit... was it a company? I don't know what it was. Somebody blamed Brexit for something that was completely unrelated. It was just laugh out loud. But but we got the elections. What's have you been looking at the figures of the way it's?
Yeah.
We know pollsters and forecasters aren't very good in this field. But what are they saying?
Right, so European elections, as you rightly say, here in the UK on Thursday and then across the weekend on the continent, and results are likely to come in on Sunday. But the polls are showing... what they've shown really since over the last month, that traditional parties are likely to receive a drubbing. And the Brexit Party polling, according to new polls today, are still as high as 33%. And one YouGov poll showing Labour with just a 15% share of the vote. They're probably, in fairness, do slightly better than that. The Tories are showing 11% to 12% of the vote. Lib Dems are probably the natural winners, but we could end up with a situation, you know, come Sunday, where there are sort of 30 to 35 staunchly anti-European UK MEPs in the new European Parliament, which will be a thorn in Europe's side, and we'll surely send a message to a final message to Westminster. It seems to me, Justin, that the major politicians and political parties still haven't really got the message, even after the local elections, that the UK public's dissatisfied. Whichever side of the Brexit debate you fall down on, I don't think anybody can be particularly impressed with the way that Parliament's conducted itself over the last 3 years, and particularly in the last year. You know, the moves to former consensus of opinion, let me say, with Labour of fallen between two stools. Now Mrs May is to ask the Cabinet if they're prepared to allow her to give Parliament the power to vote on a series of to say what they want from the government now and the way forward for Brexit and make those votes binding. We just seem to be going round in circles.
Do you know what this is going to be, then, Dad? I mean, I missed the local elections a week before, and I was a bit gutted. I was disorganised and missed it, but I'm definitely not going to miss this vote, and I'm going to go out, and my wife's going to go, and it's just one of those things that you want to I'll vote for anyone but Labour or Conservative, you know, and that's what I think a lot of people are doing. So people obviously are for Brexit and voting for Nigel Farage's party because they're a one policy party, they want to get out. Other people vote for Lib Dem, but basically anyone, vote for anyone apart from Conservative or Labour. And so let's teach them a lesson, vote, isn't it, really?
And that's the impression you get, you know, speaking to people around and about, Justin, that everybody, you know, is going to, we want everybody, but a large number of people are going to post a protest vote. You're absolutely right. And of course that feeds back into you know, the markets through the cable rate, for instance, the pound against the US dollar. We wasn't that long ago that we were trading above 130 against the US dollar. We've slipped down a couple of big figures this week already, and this morning we're now trading below 127 against the US currency. So there was a lot of optimism earlier in the year about resolution and Theresa May getting her deal through, and the pound was rallying on that. I think now the realism has dawned on people finally that we're not any further forward, and it could be a slow bleed now all the way round to the end of October, and perhaps with a power struggle, a formal power struggle within the Tory party in the middle of all of that as well. And you know, the new leader of the Tories might be able to do differently. I don't know, because the EU say they're not for budging. So again, not good news. Markets hate uncertainty, and that probably, you know, is a long way to explain the weakness in the pound on the foreign exchanges. And as I say, until some certainty appears, I think we can expect to see sterling drift lower.
Mm-hmm. Marvellous stuff. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah. Either way, we need to get something done, out or in. Just get it done. It's the uncertainty. Yeah. Just being the paralysis of being in the middle of nowhere is the damaging effect. You know.
It is certainly.
Marvellous stuff. Thanks for that, Daz, and I'll catch you next week, fella.
Thank you, Justin. Have a good week.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Zinc Media, up 6.3% at the moment, ZIN. At four, Bidstack Group, up 7.43%. Bids, of course, announced that the game, Grid Game with Codemasters, cracking game, worth looking at. Lots of ad potential in there as well. At three, Cadence Minerals. Of course, I was chatting to Kieran on the podcast earlier. At two, Thomas Cook Group. I don't understand why people are having it. It's a trade. I was arguing with Andrew Allen on the podcast yesterday. It's a trade, but it's a company swimming in debt. Debt of about four times their entire valuation. In my mind, it's an avoidable risk. Investing in stocks and shares is risky enough. The key is to avoid those risks, you know, not play into them. Of course, it could bounce, but it could go through. And at number one, most followed company is Sound Energy, SOU. Okay, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, Live Company Group, LVCG. I chatted with David on the podcast. At four, Motive Bio, orphan disease opportunity for Iqlaprim. At three, Gritland Gold, Newcrest commences drilling at Hevidon. At two, Sound Energy, strategic operational update. And number one, most liked RNS came from Bidstack Group. That's a new Codemasters game, Grid. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Don't forget, if you use the app, please give us a review at your app store. Thanks a lot. Muchos appreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.